In the early 20th century, a tradition began of celebrating March 8th as International Women's Day, an annual invitation to celebrate women's contributions to events in history as well as to contemporary society. In the early 1980s, this tradition of International Women's Day expanded in the U.S. to Women's History Week, and a few years later, to all of March as Women's History Month. In the early 20th century, one of my core convictions related to this is that the stories we tell matter. Too often, history has been told much more frequently by men and in a way that is biased toward male perspectives and experiences. And as the saying goes, if you're not at the table, you might end up on the menu. Women's History Month is an annual reminder about the importance of regularly cutting against the grain of systemic sexism and focusing on stories from our past that center the perspectives and experiences of women can inspire us to co-create a better, more equitable future. At the beginning of this year's Women's History Month, I suspect that, like me, many of you may be beginning to feel the political cauldron of this year's election year beginning to heat up. Although you will never hear us either endorse or oppose candidates for public office here from the pulpit, in the words of our UU The Vote organizers, we are nevertheless called to be powerful and prophetic without being partisan. That includes helping with get out the vote campaigns, advocating around key issues that relate to our UU values, and speaking out against actions that violate our values, including threats to democracy itself. So in preparation for this Women's History Month, I chose a book about the insights of brilliant and powerful women who lived through similar times to our own, in which freedom and democracy were under threat. Again, as the saying goes, history doesn't exactly repeat itself, but it does tend to rhyme. The book is titled The Visionaries, Arendt, Beauvoir, Rand, and Wey. It's by the philosopher Wolfram Eilenberger. Philosophy literally means the love of wisdom. And this book weaves together wisdom from the lives and work of these women over a fateful decade from 1933 to 1943 as rising tides of authoritarianism threatened Europe and as well the wider world. His previous book was Time of the Magicians, Wittgenstein, Benjamin, Kassira, and Heidegger, and the decade that reinvented philosophy. So I think after writing a book that's centered around four white dudes, he realized he needed to diversify a bit with the next one, rightly so. And I'm glad he did. This sermon wouldn't exist otherwise. However, if one of these four women particularly intrigues you, I wouldn't necessarily recommend this book. I'd instead recommend start with a biography that actually explores the whole of one of their lives rather than this book that focuses so tightly on a decade or one of their major works. Personally, I'd say start with one of the definitive biographies of Arendt or Beauvoir, depending on your time and interest. Or if you have more time to listen than to read, you can try the Reading Hannah Arendt podcast. For this morning, moving from left to right, we're going to start with Hannah Arendt, who was Jewish and born in Germany and, you know, became one of our most influential political theorists of the 20th century. Then moved to Simone de Beauvoir, a French existentialist philosopher who had a significant influence on feminist theory. Next, Ayn Rand, who was a Russian-born American philosopher known for promoting her philosophical ideas through her novels. And finally, Simone Weil, a French philosopher, mystic, and political activist. And our focus will be on the specific tools and insights from their lives that we can sort of take out for navigating our own troubling times. I realize there's a risk in trying to weave together insights from four women instead of concentrating on one, but part of the point with this is that no one person is going to save us then or now. And our challenge is to discern how we individually and collectively are called to act for such a time as this. So to set the stage, I want to invite you to hear a poem titled Today by my colleague, the Reverend Lynn Unger, that speaks to the fierce urgency of our current political moment. It's from her collection titled The Brittle Beauty of it all. She writes, "You are not wrong to be furious. You are not wrong to be scared. You're not wrong to wonder what we do today and tomorrow and tomorrow. You're not wrong to notice the brilliance of the sky. You're not wrong to think of your daughter. You're not wrong to imagine people you will never know. You're not wrong to think this will never affect me, but to really know that it really does. You're not wrong to look at pictures of puppies or kittens or flowers or trees. And you're not wrong to try to massage the ache out of your own heart. You're not wrong to yell or cry or scream or hide under the covers of your bed. And you're not wrong to turn to your neighbor and say, what do we do now?" So to begin discerning our response to that question, what do we do now in such a time as this? Let's turn to the first of our four figures, Hannah Arendt. Being born Jewish in Germany in 1906 meant that she was born on this collision course with the Third Reich. This photo is of Arendt in 1933 at age 27. That same year, Hitler came to power and the Gestapo briefly imprisoned Arendt for the so-called crime of researching anti-Semitism. After being released, she escaped to France only to soon witness Nazi Germany occupy that country as well. This defeat was particularly horrifying to Arendt because France was the birthplace in 1789 of the Declaration of the Rights of Man, this foundational human rights document. In 1941, Arendt fled again, this time to the United States, where a decade later she both became a U.S. citizen and published The Origins of Totalitarianism. This book was translated into many languages and launched her career as one of the most influential political theorists of the 20th century. I'll have to limit myself to just one quote from that book. As you hear it, keep in mind that famous passage from the U.S. Declaration of Independence that says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed with certain inalienable rights, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." In marked contrast, witnessing the totalitarian political movements of World War II, Arendt named this harsh truth, quote, "The moment that human beings lacked their own government, lacked the consent of the governed, and had to fall back upon their minimum rights, those inalienable rights, no authority was left to protect them, and no institution was willing to guarantee those rights." Here's another way of making that same point. Thomas Jefferson was correct. Human rights are inalienable. But Arendt is challenging us to notice that human rights are not inevitable. When we say that human rights are inalienable, we mean that there's nothing anyone can do to make your human rights alien from you, separate from you. There's nothing you did to deserve human rights, and there's nothing you can do to stop deserving human rights. As our UU First Principle says, we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of human beings, period. And that's deeply related. If you go and read the preamble to the UN Declaration of Human Rights and our First Principle are all deeply woven together. Human rights are your birthright, the birthright of you and every other human. But totalitarian movements remind us that nevertheless, respecting those rights is not inevitable. So that's the first tool that these visionary women invite us to put in our toolbox for today, our toolbox for resistance and resilience. Human rights are inalienable, but they are not inevitable. Since we cannot take human rights for granted in such a time as this, it is incumbent upon us to support and defend the individuals and the institutions who still respect the inalienability of human rights. There's one more related point that I can't move off Arendt without mentioning. Her other most famous book, published in 1963, was titled Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Report on the Banality of Evil. Witnessing the trial of Adolf Eichmann, one of the major organizers of the Holocaust, she was shocked to discover that he was not some unusual human monster. Eichmann presented, in her words, as, quote, terribly and terrifyingly normal. She coined the term the banality of evil to refer to the ways that we human beings can get caught up in conforming to the terrible trends in groups we're a part of or in society at large. Metaphorically, think about this. It's the difference between bad apples, saying they're just a bad apple. They're an individual who's drawn to committing evil regardless of circumstances. It's the difference between bad apples and saying, no, this is about bad barrels. Cruel societies and systems that corrupt the people in them and create the circumstances in which terrible evil is done. That's the second tool that these visionary women invite us to put in our toolbox, the banality, the ordinariness of evil. So instead of merely scapegoating bad apples, we need to look at the systems and structures that are shaping individuals to build better societal barrels that help us co-create increasingly humane, equitable, and compassionate societies. Let's shift now to our second figure, Simone de Beauvoir. As an existentialist philosopher, she was passionately committed. She would sit around in cafes, right, thinking about these great questions of life, the universe, and everything. She was committed to exploring questions that emerge from the sheer fact of our human existence. None of us asked to be here, to be alive, to be conscious, to be present in this particular and peculiar historical moment, but here we are. And so she would tell us, here we are, so what ought we or what might we do? If I had to limit myself then to one tool from her worldview to add to our toolbox for resistance and resilience, it would be the freedom of choice, the freedom to choose. But don't get her wrong. Again, she's not speaking about the freedom to choose just anything. Existentialism is clear that we are all limited by the specific historical context into which we are born. But within those circumstances, we often retain a surprising amount of choice if we're really honest with ourselves. There might be consequences, but we retain a surprising amount of choice. She and her longtime partner, Jean-Paul Sartre, pushed the envelope on many different levels of what was possible and what was permissible. I'll give you two specific examples. First, politically, her book, The Second Sex, about women's oppression, that was published in 1949, you know, quite a bit ahead of its time, and was a significant inspiration for second-wave feminism. Second, personally, she and Sartre were openly polyamorous before that was like a thing. They promised each other unconditional intellectual fidelity and honesty with an openness to other attractions. They would be absolutely necessary to each other, but also at times to others. I love this photo of Beauvoir for a number of reasons, from the gender-bending tie that she's wearing to her sort of come hither and do philosophy with me look. Kind of splayed onto the bed with these books. More seriously, she viewed totalitarianism generally and the occupation of Vichy France in particular as the exact opposite of freedom and choice, and everything she had dedicated her life to, everything this photo was about. But she refused to be held back by threats from Hitler, who she called that petite bourgeois fascist. Politically and personally, she just kept pushing into the possibilities and the freedoms and the choices that were available to her. Our third focal figure is Ayn Rand. In some ways, it's kind of like, one of these is not like the others. So in some ways, she may feel like a surprising person to include, since her books honestly have been co-opted by conservative politicians who actively are working against things like, you know, redistribution of wealth and getting rid of wealth inequality. And because class resentment is one of the main factors that create the conditions that would-be autocrats exploit. Indeed, there's an old joke about Rand's work that there are two novels that can change a bookish 14-year-old's life. Two novels. The Lord of the Rings and Atlas Shrugged. One is a childish fantasy that engenders a lifelong obsession with unbelievable heroes, leading to an emotionally and socially held back adulthood, unable to deal with the real world. The other, of course, involves orcs. The problem, in other words, is Atlas Shrugged. Now, I will confess, I was that bookish 14-year-old who did tear through both Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Anybody else? All right, there you go. But I can see now in ways I couldn't then the limitations of Rand's philosophy. That being said, it's important to reckon with the fact that her books, particularly her two novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, they've sold more than 29 million copies. There is something about them that deeply resonates with many folks at various points in their lives. Keep in mind that Rand was born in Russia. And in the context of a totalitarian regime like Stalin's Soviet Union, Rand's novels are these powerful assertions of individual freedom. And they remain valuable on that level. In ways that Rand did not appreciate, however, there is all the difference in the world between totalitarian top-down state socialism and freely chosen democratic socialism of, say, Bernie Sanders. So to add another tool to our toolbox, Rand underscores the importance of defending the freedom of individuals to choose for themselves. Our UU Fifth Principle calls this conviction the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process in our congregations and in society at large. Our fourth focal figure is Simone Weil. She's probably the least well-known of the four, but the philosopher Albert Camus called her, quote, the only great mind of our time. The only great mind of our time. That's quite a compliment from Camus. The tool that she adds to our toolbox is solidarity. All four of these women are undeniably brilliant thinkers. But more so than the others, they was willing to go much further into being in the trenches alongside historically oppressed groups. I'll give you three significant examples. The first is, although she was intellectually and spiritually drawn to pacifism, she was willing to personally take up arms in certain circumstances because she became convinced, in her words, that in the case of the Nazis, that, quote, sadly, to my acute pain, it is impossible to prevent them from doing harm without killing a certain number of them. Second, rather than merely advocating for labor justice, she took a job for a significant period of time at, honestly, quite a bit of cost to her health in a Paris metal factory to better understand firsthand the oppression of the working classes. She found the work incredibly difficult, but again persisted because she felt called to be in solidarity with others. Third, near the end of her life, when she was hospitalized for illness, she refused any special treatment out of her sense, again, of solidarity with the other patients. There's so much more to say about Weil, but I hope I've given you at least a sense of her remarkable life and her challenge to us to be in solidarity with those we feel led to help. As the saying goes from the Indigenous Rights Movement, if you have come here to help me, you are wasting your time, you know, kind of from a condescending, paternalistic place. But if you have come because you have a sense that your liberation is ultimately bound up in my liberation, then let us work together. Now, as important as all four of the women we've been studying are for resistance and for resilience in our own time, I feel like I would be remiss if our focus was only on the past without briefly looking to parallels in the present. How many of you know the name Sarah Kendzior? Yeah. Okay, I don't see many names. I see a few. Okay. I'm glad I included this then. The first name that springs to mind when I think of this is the scholar and journalist Sarah Kendzior, who her doctoral dissertation focused on how dissidents from the former Soviet Union totalitarian states used the internet to challenge authoritarian governments in a climate of surveillance and distrust. In recent years, she has turned her focus to rising authoritarian threats here in the U.S. She's the author of three books from her perspective as a longtime resident of St. Louis, Missouri. Her 2018 book is titled The View from Flyover Country. And it traces how the breakdown of institutions and social trust has set the stage for American autocracy. In 2020, she published Hiding in Plain Sight, which details what she bluntly calls a transnational crime syndicate masquerading as a government. In 2022, her most recent book came out titled They Knew. And this resonates with the conspiracy theory pieces of Arendt's thought that Sabrina mentioned earlier. They Knew, How a Culture of Conspiracy Keeps America Complacent. Kinsey Orr also publishes regularly online on Substack. Now, I'm not agreeing or endorsing with everything that she writes, but I appreciate that she has a fierce commitment to truth-telling and a no-holds-barred style. In her words, which feel highly relevant in light of the history we've been reflecting on this morning, she asks, are we supposed to treat the worst people in the world as good faith actors in defiance of logic or compassion or history and deny the obviously grim conclusions that follow? So as we strap in to make it through another election year, let us keep our tools for resistance and resilience close in hand. The importance of taking action, the actions that remain to you, the vitality of choice, of freedom, of solidarity. And if you're feeling anxious and worried, is anybody feeling anxious or worried? All right, testify. That's a very understandable feeling. But if that's the case, I would urge you to experiment with signing up for UU the Vote or a similar campaign of your choice. UU the Vote is about nonpartisan organizing to counter voter suppression, to expand democracy, and to maximize voter turnout. In both my experience and the experience of many other people that I've talked to, one of the best ways of channeling worry and anxiety is into actions for electoral justice. When I send postcards and make phone calls and send texts, etc., trying to get out the vote and protect our democracy, I find that my electoral anxiety lessens because I know I have taken action within my sphere of influence to fight the good fight and to make good trouble. So if you're interested, you don't have to remember that website link. If you just Google UU the Vote, it'll take you right there, and you can sign up right at the top of the page, put in your email address, and that'll loop you in. The campaign launches March 14th, and you'll be hearing more and more as we get closer to November. For now, I want to give the final words to Dr. Sarah Kinsey Orr. It's from an article she published at quite a fateful time in mid-November of 2016. She said, stop what you're doing and take some time right now to literally write down with a pen and paper. Write down what you value. Write down the standards that you hold for yourself and for others. Write about your dreams for the future and your hopes for your children. You still have your freedom, so use it. Do not accept brutality and cruelty as normal, even if it is sanctioned at the highest levels. Protect the vulnerable. Encourage the afraid. If you're brave, stand up for others. If you cannot be brave, and let's be honest, sometimes it's hard to be brave, at least be kind. But most of all, never lose sight of who you are and what you value. If you find yourself doing something that feels questionable or wrong a few months or years from now, she's alluding to Arendt's banality of evil, right? How society changes, becomes this bad barrel, and begins to shape us and warp us in perverse ways. If you find yourself doing something that feels questionable or wrong a few years or months from now, find those words that you wrote down about who you are and what your value, and read it. Ask if that version of yourself would have done the same thing. And if the answer is no, don't do it. Non-compliance with evil can be a major first step toward reversing the course toward authoritarianism and reverse setting our trajectory back toward greater freedom and democracy and human rights. I want to give you a final quote from Sarah Kinsey Orr. You know, in light of all, writing kind of all that she knows, you know, studying the Soviet Union and all of that totalitarian, and then studying all that she knows about our, the current state of our U.S. politics, she said, for her, it ultimately boils down to this. She said, I actually don't believe in hope, and I don't believe in hopelessness either. She said, what I believe in is compassion and pragmatism and doing what is right for its own sake. I believe in compassion, in letting your heart be broken, you know, going through the world with this big heartedness and actually giving a crap about other people, right? Like just that big heartedness. I believe in compassion. I believe in pragmatism, right? What really works? Like I was saying, anxiety doesn't work. Volunteering for UU the Vote, that works, right? So I believe in compassion. I believe in pragmatism. But as much as she believes in pragmatism, and this is that banality of evil, non-compliance with evil part, she says, ultimately, I believe in doing what is right for its own sake, period, forever and always. So as we continue our journey into the rest of today and into the week to come, continue your journey with love. Care for one another, care for this one earth, do justice, make peace, and whatever taste or touch you might have had in this time and place of hope, of love, of peace or joy, that goes with you out into the world. We're different for having spent this time together. May you live boldly. May you live with thanksgiving.